This week on the media is off to Washington, D.C.
Detroit, they make cars. Milwaukee, they make beer. In Washington, they theoretically make policy and laws, except that they don't.
The shift happened. It's over. We're over that, whatever that hump was. We're on the other side of it already.
Collectively, all of the 16 shows out there might begin to paint a cumulative portrait of Washington.
The West Wing is just a warren of tiny, tiny rooms, and they cram as many people as possible into these tiny rooms.
If you're cozy and comfortable with a media star, it's likely the case that they're just not as effective as a journalist.
You look lovely as always, Wolf. Who are you wearing?
Armani.
Well done. What's the what story are you chasing tonight?
Not chasing anything. We're here to have fun.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield. And as Congress prepares to reconvene, I take you back with me to relive a journey to the heart of darkness, or at least grayness. Yes, my springtime expedition up the wild, forbidding Potomac River to a destination On the Media had long covered, but never fully explored.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Delta's pleasure to welcome you to Washington, D.C.
Yes, Washington, D.C., which so resonates in the nation's soul, yet seems so foreign to its people that candidates campaign against it.
We have to fundamentally change how Washington works.
On the other hand, who doesn't love democracy and the Air and Space Museum? So here I am at last to explore the intersecting worlds of government, politics, commerce, and above all, the media we've spent years covering from a distance. But starting with what? Congress? The White House? K Street? You don't get to be a foreign correspondent without knowing who to turn to for the lay of the land.
I have traveled from beyond the Beltway. What can you tell me of this city and its ways?
No comment, sir. I don't grant interviews.
My cab driver doesn't grant interviews, and file that under foreshadowing. As we shall see in a moment, reportorial access can be hard to come by in this city. Occupational hazard. But I have other sources, and I head for one of Washington's most storied and essential institutions. It's noon. As the peal of nearby bells wafts down M Street, the faithful begin filing in for the sacrament of lunch. This is The Palm, a cathedral of influence where power brokers cut deals and $50 stakes under the caricatures of Washington glitterati, living and dead. Barry Goldwater, Al Hunt, Chris Christie, Mark Russell, Henry Kissinger, and 1,100 others.
Bob Woodward and Bernstein wrote all the president's men in the last booth in the back. They'd come here for lunch and write all their little papers down in their notes. That was a big story.
That's the maitre d', Tommy Giacomo, who has greeted the A-list for 41 years. To be recognized by Tommy is to be a player. He reels off a list of the Palm regulars.
James Carville, Mary Madeline, whenever they're in town, they live here, you know, they just love the place. Al Fromm just left. Wolf Blitzer comes in all the time.
Today is wolfless, but no matter. I'm here to meet my fixer, the local guy who can help me make connections, grease wheels, and translate. He is Mark Leibovich, political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and author of the best-selling This Town, which is kind of like a Washington version of the Hollywood map of the stars, but not their homes. It's where the bodies are buried.
Detroit, they make cars. Milwaukee, they make beer. In Washington, they theoretically make policy and laws, except that they don't.
What they do build here in D.C. is relationships, and not the Dr. Phil kind.
It's me as a lobbyist trying to nurture a relationship with you, a chief of staff for Congressman X or Senator Y. It's, you know, me as a reporter being taken to lunch by some flack who's probably billing some company this because, hey, they have a relationship with Mark, the reporter, and that's worth something. This is not making anything except noise and a lot of people very rich.
The lesson of Leibovich's book is that ambitious people flock to Washington ostensibly to conduct the people's business, but soon focus on their own. Governance becomes an afterthought, or worse, a goose farm for feathering their own nests. And the media are enablers, often participants in the whole sordid economy. I immediately got into the swing of things.
Off the menu, you've got a ribeye blackened slice served over Caesar salad available, and we have a sautéed zucchini with shallots as a vegetable. 3, 4, 5-pound lobsters as well.
I got to ask you, what's the price of a 5-pound lobster?
$130.
$130. Yeah, we'll have the $130 lobster, please.
You know what they say, when in DuPont Circle.
You're in a really good place now, Bob. People come in here, they're going to be impressed, especially when they see what we ordered.
In this hour, we'll explore perception and reality, money and celebrity, and the evolving role of the media in the nation's capital.
Look, McGovern's dropped to nothing. Nixon's guaranteed the renomination. The Post is stuck with a story no one else wants. It'll sink the goddamn paper. Everyone says, get off it, Ben, and I come on very sage, and I say, well, you'll see, you wait till this bottoms out. But the truth is, I can't figure out what we've got.
What he had, Ben Bradley, that is, as portrayed by Jason Robards in All the President's Men, was a story that ultimately dislodged a president and secured the Washington Post immortality in the pantheon of American journalism. Of late, however, the paper has fallen on hard times. Daily print circulation, which generates most of the income, is at half its 1994 peak. Advertising revenues have halved in the past 5 years. Before Amazon's Jeff Bezos stepped in last fall to buy it from the Graham family for $250 million, the Post had recently been losing roughly $75 million a year. It's all part of the chaos inflicted on almost all traditional publishers by the digital revolution. As Conan O'Brien reminded everyone at the 2013 White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Some people say print media is dying, but I don't believe it. And neither does my blacksmith.
What with the formal wear and all, the affair had a sort of captain's table on the Titanic vibe. Although that's a characterization the Post's executive editor Martin Barron strenuously dismisses, at least for his newspaper.
It's far from that Titanic. I think we're doing extremely well. We do incredible work, agenda-setting work.
True. The Post just won two more Pulitzer Prizes, one for its part in covering the Edward Snowden NSA leaks. But what about the upstart competition, the Graham's capitulation to financial extremists, and that slight, you know, newspaper industry-wide death spiral?
Well, I don't think we're in a death spiral. I think that the industry is reinventing itself. We have 26 million unique visitors online and growing. But our audience is far broader than print. It's worldwide. It's nationwide. And I think what we're doing in that sphere is really impressive.
Actually, it's up to 32 million unique visitors. And they're nothing to sneeze at, although 90% of them are outside the D.C. area, and the ad revenue they generate is pitiful compared to the obscenely profitable good old days. But hold the thought. We'll be back to Barron later. Because if the reinvention of the news industry is going on, it didn't start at 15th and L. Just across the Potomac in Arlington, Virginia, resides Politico, a newspaper named for its target audience. Founded by two Post reporters 7 years ago, it quickly became an inside-the-beltway institution. Co-founder and editor John Harris.
We do not try to be all things to all people, but we are obsessed with dominating the Washington conversation.
As such, Politico is equal parts stock market ticker and the daily racing form, both monitoring and handicapping every up and down in the political fortunes of a person or policy initiative. For better or worse, it is the paper of record for the horse race.
Are we indispensable in Washington at the most elite and consequential levels of politics and policymaking? Must we be read in House Speaker John Boehner's office because we're producing journalism that is of such consequence? Is the West Wing of the White House reading Politico, not just to see what we're covering, but because, like, we're genuinely informative and revelatory to them. When the answer is yes, we're succeeding.
They're succeeding, as evidenced by both the Post and the New York Times newly mimicking Politico's signature feature, an early morning newsletter called Playbook that has become something of official Washington's unofficial agenda. Harris doesn't fault them, but does advise his legacy competitors to identify their knitting and stick to it.
What I would say, if I were editor of the Washington Post, or to be honest, if I were editor of any publication, is what is our comparative advantage, to use the economist's phrase? What do we do distinctively well?
Funny he should ask. Back across the river, not far from Chinatown, I trudge up the stairs to a loft space. Exposed brick, IKEA furniture, four young non-ink-stained reporters at their computers, including one chasing down a lead.
Yeah, hi. Is President Brewer available? My name is Evan Santoro. I'm a reporter with BuzzFeed in Washington. I'm working on a story about something he said about a meeting with Eric Holder.
Yes, on the subject of knowing what you do best, my location is the Washington Bureau of BuzzFeed, the world's leading arbiter of cat video greatness. As I write this, BuzzFeed's homepage headlines include 26 must-have spring flats for under $50 and 28 shocking pictures that prove that the Illuminati is all around us. But now BuzzFeed joins Politico, the Huffington Post, the Daily Caller, Vox, the Drudge Report, Atlantic.com, Bloomberg, and hundreds of other online outlets for national politics and policy to mammothly outpage view the powers that were. The bureau chief is John Stanton.
We have caught the attention of the people in Congress, the attention of people in the White House, the people on K Street, and importantly, I think, the public as well, particularly the younger demographic, which all of those people want. They want their attention, and we are really becoming the outlet that does that.
Stanton is 6'7", with a shaved head, skull rings, and tattoos covering his arms. He's wearing a T-shirt that says, of course, Worlds Collide. He looks like a bouncer, basically, which he was once. But now, he's on the list.
We don't write about a bill that passes. We don't write, you know, about the micro movements on the politics behind a bill. But we will try to find a way to write about that that gives the readers and the public some kind of context on what's happening in Washington. I did a story this last winter about what happens when you get deported if you're Mexican and what your life is like when you get back to Mexico. And that was a way to sort of show people about the immigration debate and what is happening there in an angle that at the time was not really being looked at by people.
But it's not just the news features he can cherry pick from the traditional media's orchard. It's the effect the new ecosystem has on the old guard. The Post's most viewed story of the past year wasn't the Snowden leaks. It was a listicle of shoddily built hotel rooms in Sochi for the Olympics. The BuzzFeedization of the man, John Stanton.
Easy to understand and shareable and catchy. Watching them learn that and go from sort of poo-pooing us and saying, oh, you know, all you guys do is these lists or whatever, to suddenly realizing that, like, you know, these kinds of lists and this kind of journalism is just a new take on an old form. I mean, it's satisfying, I guess.
Satisfying, I guess.
If they want to do what we do, that's great.
Okay, but what about BuzzFeed's ability to do what the Post does? Will Stanton's reporter, Evan Santoro, get his phone call returned on the Eric Holder story?
The folks that work here, they get their phone calls returned. They get scoops given to them by random people they've never talked to because those people know that giving it to us means something. Even the White House understands that if you shrug us off, that's going to come back to bite you in the ass.
Well, I think it depends on who you're trying to reach.
Garance Franchi-Ruta, formerly of the Washington Post and the Atlantic, now Washington editor for Yahoo News.
I mean, the president has reached out to all kinds of different media with advertising and with interviews. You know, he's done stuff with Reddit. He's done stuff with all kinds of different publications. There's just more people.
More people in the hunt for stories and more people in the audience. The Washington Post has 32 million monthly unique visitors. The New York Times has 67 million. Huffington Post has 90 million. BuzzFeed, more than 130 million. Yahoo has 800 million. No living journalist lay awake at night as a child dreaming of writing for Yahoo News, but almost a billion potential readers? Yahoo!
I think there's a lot of attention still to the shift as if it's something that is new and happening. The shift happened. It's over. We're over that, whatever that hump was. We're on the other side of it already.
Which is why the Post's Marty Baron is unapologetically copying Playbook, launching vertical blogs, publishing listicles, and search engine optimizing everything.
One of the reasons why we face such economic challenges is because we have a proliferation of competitors in a way that we never had before. Newspapers in the past were oligopolies or in some cases monopolies. That's not the case today, all right? We're competing in that environment. We intend to experiment every which way, and I expect that we will succeed. Just because we don't have all the answers today does not mean that we won't arrive at answers in the future.
I guess I'll save the most important question for last. Ben Bradley had Jason Robards. Who's playing you?
You really don't expect me to answer that.
No. But as we'll see in a moment, it was not a stupid question. Coming up, Hollywood on the Potomac. Can you understand our democracy via House of Cards? This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The digital revolution has not only pitted the traditional Washington media in a battle for audience with competitors, it has put them in a battle for an audience with certain key government figures, notably the President of the United States. George W. Bush used to brag about avoiding the media filter. Barack Obama makes his predecessor look like Mr. Accessible. A recent Politico poll shows that 8 times as many White House correspondents think Bush was more open than Obama than think the opposite. And as I discovered in an earlier expedition, the press corps can do little about it but fume. Marine One circles in the winter rain and alights on the White House South Lawn, returning from a staged event at a Virginia shipyard to gin up support for the administration's revenue proposals. President Obama decopters and strides purposefully across the soggy grass toward the Oval Office. Witnessing this extremely high-level walking are some 50 observers huddled under umbrellas and making small talk. Cameras click and whir in perfunctory unison. The return leg from Newport News to Washington No News has been duly recorded. Ladies and gentlemen, your White House press corps in action.
In anticipation of the meeting Friday, the president did invite four leaders.
Inside the briefing room, that's Press Secretary Jay Carney lulling his audience into a state of unconsciousness. As blogger Anna Marie Cox once put it, the White House is where news goes to die, or at least slip into a coma. I asked CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett about being disrespected by the administration. Walking Dead seemed rude, so I used the slightly less pejorative term, stenographer.
The president has a message. He's the leader of the free world, and his message deserves to be communicated. That is a prerogative of the presidency. Conveying that accurately is not stenography, and I don't consider that beneath me.
The question is, what is going around him? Once upon a time, his was an elite circle, the only intermediary between the White House and the electorate. Those dynamics every now and then yielded genuine drama, such as the 1974 confrontation between CBS's Dan Rather and President Richard Nixon.
Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
Tens of millions of people tuned into what were then all three networks gasped at Rather's impertinence. But today's reporters and photographers have been marginalized by a gazillion other channels. Twitter, Facebook, the White House's ongoing blog, the Ask Me Anything forum on Reddit, and on TV, not much evening news, but plenty of Live at 5, David Letterman, and The View. The White House is now itself a kind of media house. Ann Compton of ABC News.
They become publishers. They become journalists. They become their own advertising agency.
Never mind one-on-ones with the president, says Compton, who's covering her seventh presidential administration. Most of the time, reporters can't even get access enough to shout out questions at a grip-and-grin session.
We don't cover Oval Office photo ops. We don't cover many of the meetings he has when he meets with people on immigration or gun violence or the fiscal cliff, the meetings with Congress. It's been 6 months since I've even been in the Oval Office on my turn to be the pool member in there. To shut the media out to the extent this administration has, I think, is a disgrace.
A complaint that White House Deputy Press Secretary Joshua Earnest shrugged off.
Sometimes the president's commitment to engaging with the American public means that there are some members of the White House press corps who get a little frustrated that they're not getting as many interviews as they would like. But at the end of the day, the president's responsibility is not to the members of the White House press corps. It's actually to the American public. In order to fulfill his responsibility to communicate his priorities, the president needs to avail himself of all the opportunities to do that.
Actually, the president's responsibility to the public is not to communicate his priorities. It's to answer for his actions. Hence, the PR strategy to answer easier questions. While the captive White House press corps cooled its heels approximately 20 feet away recently, the president sat down with anchors from eight local stations from around the country. Among them, Kevin Ogle of KFOR Oklahoma City, who didn't necessarily go for the jugular.
You know, here I am, some local yokel from Oklahoma City, getting to go up and interview the president, and we had limited time, and so there's not a lot of opportunity to ask follow-up questions, you know, or to take him to task on things.
In other words, no Nixon versus Rather moments?
No, it wasn't like that at all.
Instead, Ogle passed along viewer questions, including one from basketball star Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
This comes from KD. Putting your loyalty to the Bulls aside, what are your thoughts on Oklahoma City's Thunder basketball team? You know who KD is?
I do. I've had a chance to play with him. He's a great guy.
In contrast, Susan Peters of KAKE Cake Wichita was fairly aggressive in questioning Obama's plan to cut tax exemptions for Kansas's big corporate aircraft industry. That's right after she handed the president a scrapbook she made of his mom's Kansas heritage. I wondered if she thought she and her local colleagues had been fully respected. Did you get the sense that they looked at you, all eight of you, like eight Ron Burgundies?
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal.
I don't know if they looked at us like Ron Burgundies, but to be honest with you, it was thrilling. It was thrilling being in the White House interviewing the president of the United States.
Before I left the briefing room, I ran into E.J. Dionne, inveterate political analyst for The Washington Post, PBS, and NPR. I asked him if this administration has perfected the end around.
Well, I think all presidents try to get around the press corps, and now there are more opportunities to do it. But there is still a very large share of the population that's going to get its news mediated, no matter how much we talk about the irrelevance of traditional journalism. It's still a big enough audience that they have to worry about it.
Yep, are we ready?
And with that, Dionne went into a briefing about the sequestration showdown for a handful of the press corps. On background, of course. So, no, the lights in the White House briefing room won't be switched off anytime soon. The place still plays an important role.
We talked at length about the president's offer to Speaker
But to understand how things have changed, one merely needs to look up at the podium as Jay Carney reads scripted answers to a reporter's question. Just behind him, next to the iconic White House seal, hangs a giant flat-screen TV scrolling all the up-to-the-minute headlines. The source? The White House blog. Let's say you're an American, and let's say you therefore get most of your information from TV. You've long had two ways to form your understanding of inside Washington, D.C.
Cloture motion. We, the undersigned senators, in accordance with the provisions of Rule
C-SPAN, viewed by dozens of Americans each day, or there was this.
Are you all right, Mr. President?
No one was hurt. Someone shot at the press room from the sidewalk.
Well, well, well.
Carl, not so full of yourself when you're not surrounded by your cronies, are you, Congressman?
Last 10 days, 8 blondes have been abducted in Washington from this area. What do you make of that?
Well, it's either a conspiracy or some guy's got a pretty weird hobby.
West Wing, Murphy Brown, Get Smart, just a few examples of how, ever since the invention of TV, Washington has served as an entertainment setting, reflecting our abiding interest in pretend law enforcement, pretend intelligence gathering, pretend politics, and pretend governance. But things have changed. These days, viewers aren't just sporadically consuming Washington Fair, but binging on House of Cards, Alpha House, Veep, Scandal, and an even dozen other shows currently set in the district or its environs. Because, as it turns out, not only does the lifeblood of democracy flow through this city, TV-wise, it is O-negative blood. The universal donor.
You can have comedy, you can have satire, you can have a thriller.
Bo Willimon, low-level Democratic apparatchik turned writer, is the creator and executive producer of House of Cards.
Because there are so many different types of stories to be told in D.C. and because the stakes are so high, it sort of lends itself to a whole range of possibilities.
Such as, for instance, the genre of omniscient, omnipotent intelligence and security agencies with the ability to get a satellite image of a terrorist on a big screen in 4 seconds with only 6 employees, like Homeland, Covert Affairs, or NBC's The Blacklist.
After Rifkin was caught, Cooper had him flown from Bagram to Andrews Air Force Base in Virginia. And there, prison transport took them to a federal holding facility in Alexandria.
Andrews Air Force Base and Alexandria. How very Beltway. Not to be confused with Inside the Beltway, the arcane geography of official Washington that is a genre unto itself. We are now awash in programs devoted ostensibly to how Washington works. It works cynically, it seems, whether portrayed in comedies like Amazon Prime's Alpha House.
There's a reason why half of all Americans in Afghanistan are private contractors. Because they get the job done cheaper and more efficiently than the military. Carthage Security Systems is the gold standard of private security.
Hey, isn't Carthage one of your biggest contributors?
Gee, you think?
Or the West Wing meets Macbeth sensation, House of Cards.
Trust me or not, but I'm about to be confirmed as the vice president, and our relationship extends to the Oval Office now. Don't step out of the sunlight for no reason.
That's Kevin Spacey as vice president-designate Frank Underwood, moments before doing something very, very evil to a reporter played by Kate Mara. I'll say this in code for spoiler alert's sake. Underwood submitted to the impulse felt by many a politician by Ushing Pei, the e-porter Ray in front of the moving Metro Ain tray.
I want to believe you, Francis. No, you...
It's ludicrous, of course. Vice presidents never take the subway. But this Netflix original melodrama about duplicity, corruption, and ruthless grasping for power has taken hold. Because the spot-on details of legislative procedure, political horse trading, and underlying ruthlessness feel so real. Bo Willimon.
Very few politicians, arguably none, operate with the extremes to which Francis Underwood operates. But I do think that there's elements, a lust for power, choices that politicians are making all the time that force them to confront their own ethical boundaries that are a fabric of Washington. I think that collectively, all of the 16 shows out there might begin to paint a cumulative portrait of Washington.
The version of Washington that exists on the majority of television shows bears almost no relation to the actual gridlocked place where theoretical governing actually gets done.
Andy Greenwald has written about D.C.-based TV for the website Grantland.
What we instead see is a sort of a Roman Colosseum full of schemers in suits backstabbing and front-stabbing their way to power.
The Grand Opera is fetching, he says, but false. While Spacey, as the House Democratic whip wrangling votes, has some procedural verisimilitude, and his moral bankruptcy plays to our worst suspicions, for the ring of truth, Greenwald prefers Julia Louis-Dreyfus's HBO comedy, Veep.
POTUS is anxious after recent events that you don't feel he's trying to nudge you out of the process of government.
Oh, isn't that thoughtful, Amy?
So he would like you to head up a program that is very important and very dear to his heart.
No. You do not do this to me. Do not say that it is obesity. Do not say that to me.
It's obesity.
No.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but you have drawn the fat straw.
Sad sack. People with giant egos and lanyards hanging around their necks and bad pleated pants. It demystifies it in a way that I think some people might find ultimately more depressing than the story of a backroom whip who tramples over the Constitution.
Grant Land's Andy Greenwald. Armando Iannucci, creator of Veep, was indeed struck by the grinding glamorlessness within the palaces of power.
The West Wing is just a warren of tiny, tiny rooms, and they cram as many people as possible into these tiny rooms. So a table that is room enough for three or four computer monitors actually has seven or eight of them on, and people crammed up. And very respectable, powerful-looking middle-aged men in suits sitting rumpled up on spare sofas and seats in corridors because there isn't a desk for them.
So, yes, it rings very true. On the other hand, the conflict is so mundane compared to Scandal, where crisis management team member Quinn Perkins is really Lindsay Dwyer, who either did or did not kill her boyfriend and five others with a bomb before being kidnapped and having her identity forcibly changed.
I ran her prints. Don't worry, I did it myself, which is a good thing, because otherwise there'd be about half a dozen U.S. agencies looking for her.
And why not? In a real world where citizens accept mythical death panels and Kenyan moles in the Oval Office, where precisely should we suspend disbelief? Veep's Armando Iannucci.
I think people feel frustrated. They feel that they're not being heard. In the news and in current affairs, there is a vacuum because politics isn't progressing. And in that vacuum, you know, come idiots like me and comedians and dramatists and turn it into entertainment. It's our attempt to try and make some kind of sense over what we see is happening on the national political stage. Sense or nonsense.
The question is, do artists use politics as a prism for refracting our human selves? Or is it merely an exercise in allowing myth to fill in the yawning gaps of our understanding, like ancient stargazers connecting celestial dots to see the gods? I asked Bo Willimon if the sordid goings-on in House of Cards is a proxy for real understanding of the political process.
A proxy for understanding presumes that there is an actual understanding that you can either get right or get wrong. And I don't think that one can pinpoint a clear, definable understanding of Washington and the way it works, just like one can't do the same for the soul.
Good answer, albeit probably besides the point. When it comes to portraying the nation's capital, what matters is not how Washington works, but how television works, namely with noise and spectacle and trumped-up conflict. Always has.
Okay, quickly, quickly.
And he's under a lot of pressure to make these reports.
3 seconds. The CIA fight takes a lot longer to resolve.
What do you say?
It will take so long that there'll be a new administration in power.
That's the McLaughlin Group, just one of many venues where pundits go every week to be wrong. Call it House of Canards. The only difference is how you take your fiction. Coming up, watchdogs in tuxedos, when the press hobnobs with the people it should be reporting on. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Washington, D.C. is a dateline, and it is an industry. Perhaps more than any other city, the capital is a place where the marketplace of ideas has been overtaken by the just plain marketplace. Even political gridlock is good for business.
Nothing gets done in Washington, Bob.
My fixer and spirit guide, Mark Leibovich.
The only thing that gets done here is that people get rich. It is a city in which we have not so much Democrats and Republicans, but millionaires.
All Leibovich sees is an orgy of self-dealing, a culture perpetuated by, exploited by, and occasionally indulged in by the media. For instance, there is the symbiotic relationship between cable news channels and political operatives, who equally benefit when partisans are anointed on-air wise men. MSNBC cohabits with Al Sharpton and ex-presidential press secretary Robert Gibbs. Fox has punditized Democratic influence peddler Lanny Davis and GOP sorcerer Karl Rove.
I can't think of a single significant promise or pledge made about the Affordable Care Act that has been kept by this administration.
Money also fattens the political economy whenever the press pumps up its own audience by playing and replaying campaign smears. Ironically, while underreporting, the money trail leading to the smearers.
Fearful the ads questioning the senator's war record are having an impact, the Kerry campaign has responded with a new TV ad of its own to be broadcast in three battleground states.
And if the press and the political class are really adversaries, what are we to make of events like the White House Correspondents' Dinner and its endless associated party crawl? Media organizations spending fortunes to host the crowd they're supposed to be scrutinizing. It all brings to mind Milo Minderbinder in Catch-22. It's all for the syndicate, and everyone has a share. I'm not speaking of graft exactly, certainly not the Jack Abramoff bribing congressman sort. It's more like a mentality, a buy-in to the trappings of ambition when public service and the coverage thereof becomes an industry. To better understand those impulses, I paid a call on one of the most prominent dealmakers, a man who monetizes Washington-born media-fueled celebrity like no other.
I represent 300 and some television news correspondents, producers, anchors with their employment agreements.
Lawyer Bob Barnett of the firm Williams & Connolly, situated literally between Capitol Hill and K Street. The man has more clients than I have Facebook friends.
I also help a lot of people who leave government from the Senate, from the House, from the Cabinet, from the White House, shape their private sector duties.
That's why you've been described as a doorman to the revolving door.
What I'm basically doing is helping them determine what their real goals are and helping them fit those goals with the opportunities that are either presented to them or that I can help them seek.
There are, of course, laws and ethics regulations governing the cashing in process, and Barnett makes sure his clients don't run afoul of them. But he is not unaware of unseemliness. It is, in fact, on precisely such grounds that he declines to mention his mega-famous clients out loud, because one simply wouldn't. So as I stand at his office bookcase, he silently points to one Barnett-represented volume after another, permitting me to narrate.
Bill Clinton, Bob Woodward, Sarah Palin, Elizabeth Warren, Ben Bradley, Hillary Clinton, James Baker, David Gergen, Dick Cheney, Charles Krauthammer, Alan Greenspan. My goodness gracious. Catherine Graham, Edward M. Kennedy, George W. Bush, Madeleine Albright, The Reagan Diaries, Tim Russert. Yeah, okay. That's a pretty good client roster.
And yes, those were major media figures stacked jacket to jacket with senior government officials.
Was a time that we in the media were kind of ink-stained wretches in rumpled suits, duly and unglamorously reporting the doings of government and politics. And now some number of us are stars ourselves. We are players. We are bold-faced names. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
They become recognizable. They become controversial. They become the subject of attention. Nothing they can do about being well-known from the work they do in their day job, from writing books, from appearing as talking heads or whatever. But the best of them try to maintain a sense of dispassionate objectivity. Some do it better than others.
So that's one way for a journalist to tap into the Washington, D.C. economy. Another way is to simply switch sides. And 'twas ever thus. 20 years ago, Wall Street Journal reporter Jeffrey Birnbaum, author of The Lobbyists, was on C-SPAN talking about the people who trade public service for private opportunity.
It's played out hundreds of times over the years. People who came to Washington to work on the Hill and to try to, you know, do good, and they ended up in many ways doing well.
And by well, he means
Birnbaum understands the almightiness of the dollar. In another book, The Money Men, The Real Story of Fundraising's Influence on Political Power in America, he framed the problem most succinctly. Quote, "We all know vaguely that something is wrong in Washington, especially with its money culture." Thing is, Birnbaum is no longer at the Wall Street Journal. He's at BGR Group, which describes itself as a powerhouse in lobbying, public relations, and investment banking. Yes, like many Washington reporters before him, the man who spent a career explaining the influence peddling trade has traded up.
I moved from being a journalist to being an advocate, which I am quite happily. And it's my job to help clients in the way that they would like to be helped, to help them advocate their positions.
Does your role as an advocate for clientele sometimes force you into a position that would have made you extremely queasy as a journalist because you have personal or political issues with the client?
It's my job to advocate positions, and I don't take on clients whose positions, as you say, make me queasy.
For the record, last year, BGR's clientele included insurance, gambling, and defense, plus the Republic of Kazakhstan, ruled iron-fistedly by President for Life Nursultan Nazarbayev. That made me wonder aloud about Birnbaum's threshold of queasiness. Have I walked into the dark side?
No, you haven't.
Why haven't I?
You're going to have to. Hold on 1 second.
Here he's gestured for me to turn off my tape recorder. And so I did, whereupon he explained that Kazakhstan is no longer a client. But anyway, even though it's never had a free and fair election, it is evolving and also so loaded with oil, uranium, and other resources that even the Obama administration sucks up to it. Then back on went the recorder.
I think that it's a misunderstanding of what people do in Washington. To the extent that a journalist, for example, is a fair broker of conveying information, and you consider that to be a public good, then it is a public good. But people have very different views about what is a public good.
Evidently. But also different views about what just smells funny. And so I wanted to hear just one more voice to understand how all these blurred lines appear, not just to the public, which already loathes both politicians and the press, but to the actual bad guys, the scavengers who themselves feed on the carrion of lost altruism. If you are a jackal, what do you think when the watchdog starts sniffing your hindquarters?
If you're cozy and comfortable with a media star, a media commentator, a media celebrity, it's likely the case that they're just not as effective as a journalist.
Ladies and gentlemen, convicted felon, ex-jailbird, and born-again ethicist, Mr. Jack Abramoff.
Out of social obligation and out of filial approach to their new friends and their cocktail party buddies, they're likely to forego the kind of hard journalistic approach that others will take. Not with everybody, but certainly with their buddies. This is the way things have evolved. This is a business.
As we spoke, we were days away from an event where precisely such fraternization would take place, in black tie, no less, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. What message, I asked him, does that send?
Well, if I were a journalist and I wanted to be taken seriously as a journalist and somebody who had the public's trust in mind, I think it highly unlikely that I would ever don a tuxedo in Washington, D.C.
These days, the House Republicans actually give John Boehner a harder time than they give me, which means orange really is the new black.
That was Barack Obama, 10 minutes into his monologue this past May, ridiculing the permatan of his political nemesis. It was an almost perfect joke, just like the White House Correspondents' Dinner itself. Almost everything you need to know about the Correspondents' Dinner is that there is a red carpet.
Fox! Fox!
That hollering is the working press, cordoned behind retractable belt barriers, here vying for the attention of, I swear to God, Greta Van Susteren. Oh, yeah, I was penned in there too. You know, journalizing, just like my colleagues.
Hi, I'm Bob Garfield from On the Media. What story are you chasing tonight?
Oh, we're just talking to celebs, seeing why they're here, just chatting.
Your news organization?
I'm with USA Today.
What do you hear after today?
Fun moments on the red carpet, trying to mix the fun of the politicians with the crazy of the celebrities.
Who are you?
I'm with ABC.
On the Media is hosting a media ethics colloquy at 7 tonight. You guys interested?
Well, right now I'm zipping back. I'm only here for part-time. I'm handing this off, so.
More on that media ethics thing in a minute. But I will say that the red carpet delivered these folks their stars. CNN's Suzanne Malveaux chatted up Scandal's Scott Foley.
It is so incredible because nobody thought that the White House administration could be that scandalous or that sexy.
Well, that's scandalous or sexy. Thank you.
Someone snagged one of the Duck Dynasty guys.
I think everybody just looking around. I was staring at everybody around me.
And check out Uzo Adubo of Orange is the New Black.
Is there anyone here that you're trying to, like, casually stand next to and talk to?
I'm trying to casually stand next to Kevin Hart. I also would like to very casually and or aggressively be next to Wolf Blitzer from CNN.
I know, right?
You look lovely as always, Wolf. Who are you wearing?
Armani.
Well done. What's the what story are you chasing tonight?
I'm not chasing anything. We're here to have fun.
Correct. CNN hosted New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Texas Governor Rick Perry, a White House special assistant, and a couple of members of Congress. CBS had HUD Secretary Sean Donovan. The Washington Post had Transportation's Anthony Fox. Yahoo News had Attorney General Eric Holder. ABC had Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, whose department routinely ignores press questions about detaining and abusing American citizens at the border, and lethal force against unarmed suspects. But Johnson and the others sat there in their tuxedos, offering nothing more to their news organization hosts than the basket of dinner rolls, in no jeopardy whatsoever of journalism breaking out. In the week leading up to the event, I asked Steve Tama, president of the Correspondents Association, about the propriety of cozying up to the very officials his membership is supposed to be watchdogging.
Every reporter in this town who covers a beat, we all take people out to lunch or dinner, either because we're already talking to them every day or we're hoping they'll return our calls and talk every day. And I just don't have a problem with it. It's up to every journalist what they do with their source. We're just not going to get involved in that relationship.
Abusive though it may be. As we heard earlier in this hour, this is an administration that has systematically stiffed the press corps for 6 years. Access is so bad, the press usually can't even take photos at photo ops. The White House Correspondents' Dinner, putting reporters face-to-face with Obama for 5 solid hours, was by far their longest presidential encounter of the year. Yet, of course, not one question about Ukraine, immigration, the Keystone Pipeline, the budget, the NSA, the climate, the Mideast peace process, or anything else. As for everyday opportunities to see the president, Tom assured me that objections of the Correspondents Association and its allies have been duly registered at the White House.
And we believe we have made some progress, particularly for the cameras, for photojournalists. We think that we're getting them in more often than we used to.
A lot of progress?
Some progress.
Significant progress?
We'll get to significant progress.
In the Hilton Grand Ballroom, the sound of shoulders rubbing. Up on the second floor was the sound of crickets chirping. As dinner convened downstairs, On the Media did indeed host an ethics colloquy that we named Red Carpets and Red Flags, featuring American University journalism professor Patricia Afterheide, Jeffrey Goldberg of Bloomberg News, my fixer Mark Leibovich of the New York Times Magazine, and me. Refreshments were served to us because nobody else showed up.
So you think people are going to come? Where did you put the poster?
This thing's been a complete flop. I mean, it's looked a little bit demoralizing.
I think we can call it. It's
7:25.
It's been great, guys.
Yeah, you want to take some donuts with you?
I actually took them back with me. Back beyond the Beltway, where I'd pretty much lost my appetite.
Washington, D.C., it's the greatest place to be. It's not the cherries everywhere in bloom. It's not the way they put folks on the moon. No, no, no. It's not the spectacles and pageantry, the thousand things you've got to see. It's just that's where my baby waits.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. All of the heavy lifting for this show was done by the amazing Sarah Abdurakhman. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay. And our show was edited this week by Brooke and our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
It's my baby's kiss that keeps me coming. Mr. Garfield, your usual table, please, right this way.
Tommy, how you doing, man?
Your usual table, sir.
How's the lobster today?
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.